JAMA Audiobooks presents Crow Mountain by Lucy Inglis, narrated by Evita Jay and Caitlin Thorburn. You already possess everything necessary to become great. Absolute proverb. Prologue.
Hope! The taxi's here!
Meredith shouted. Hope rammed the last of her stuff into her black nylon holdall.
Coming!
She clumped down the stairs, lugging her heavy bags, as her mother stood in the hall, looking at the clock. He's cutting it fine.
We've got hours, Mum.
And hours of hanging around in airports for the next day.
Do you have everything you need? Where we're going is very remote.
Where we go is always very remote. And yes, I have everything, I think. The black cab driver beeped his horn. Meredith threw open the door, letting in London's pale spring sunshine.
Then let's go.
The driver rolled his window down.
Taxi for West.
That's us. When they were loaded into the cab, he checked their destination.
Heathrow, Terminal 5, ladies?
Yes, please, Meredith said curtly, clearly annoyed with his familiar tone. As they left the end of their road, he began to make conversation.
Going on holiday?
No, work.
What's your work, then?
He asked, with the typical bluntness of a London cabbie.
I'm an environmental and forest ecosystem scientist specialising in subalpine microclimates.
Hope squashed a sigh. Meredith was more than usually on edge when they had to make a flight.
A sub... Righto,
the driver continued, undeterred.
Where are you working, then?
Montana, on the edge of the Glacier National Park, for a month. He whistled, pulling into the traffic heading for the North Circular.
Had a man from Montana in my cab once. Know what they say about it?
No, Meredith said.
They call it the last best place.
Because of its remarkable ecology?
No, because of how it's one of the least populated places in America. You can lose yourself in the wilderness there and never be found. The Unabomber, outlaws, people like that. Go off the grid in Montana and you're never seen again.
He glanced at Hope in the rearview mirror.
The real Wild West.
Chapter 1. Youth is a season of impression. Montana, 1867. The camp was a jumble, full of rough men and women, animals, dirt, and noise. I stood aside, out of the thoroughfare, waiting for the others. The street, the only main street in Helena, was full of clapboard frontages with painted signs. At the edges, plots were still pegged out with strings and stakes. Between the buildings, undergarments hung on washing lines in alleyways. Not far away, in a side street, someone had made a pig pen, and the stench was in the air. Helena, it seemed, was to be like every other camp we had visited on our long and arduous journey. My heart sank. Miss Adams stood with me as Mr. Goldsmith climbed down, stiff-limbed, from the roof of the coach and began to fetch our overnight boxes. Mr. Goldsmith had told me interesting stories about the history of America as we crossed the varied landscapes of the Great Plains. Or at least he had, until Miss Adams made him sit outside on the roof with the teamsters who were escorting us, deeming his many nuggets of information unnecessary for my ears.
"Come, you cannot stand out here,"
Miss Adams said, pushing through the doors of the hotel. Like all those on the trail, it was busy and accommodated a bar. I had never been exposed to working, drinking men in England, and found their bold stares and filth terrifying.
"Don't look, Miss Forsyth, it only encourages them."
The hotel owner appeared. He wore, like so many American men, an unattractive droopy moustache, greasy from lip-licking. There are a pair of spectacles with green lenses resting on the top of his balding head.
"Good afternoon, ladies," he said cheerfully. "Spencer party?"
We were travelling under the name of Spencer for more than one reason. The first was that Papa thought it prudent I, whilst travelling with so small a party, remain anonymous. The second was that with the displacement from the Sioux Wars and so many people coming to the Montana goldfields, even the meanest places were full. Making multiple reservations in more than one name was somewhat dishonest, to my way of thinking, but had, on two occasions so far, secured us rooms when otherwise we would have been sleeping in the nearest pigpen. Still, we had perhaps only another 3 weeks of this before arriving at our destination, Portland. There I would meet the man I was engaged to marry, Anthony Howard Stanton, from the family of the biggest railway constructors in America. Presently they were engaged in building a West Coast infrastructure, hence our rendezvous in Portland, where he was working on the branch line. We were to live in San Francisco, on Larkin Street, opposite Yerba Buena Park. The house was newly finished and already had a full staff waiting for our arrival. Miss Adams allowed the hotel keeper's wife to show us to our accommodation as I trailed behind them, lost in thought. Married life. I was not quite 16. Very young for marriage, I knew it. It wasn't that I didn't know how to run a household, for I did. But the idea of being a wife kept me awake in the small hours. What if he could not love me, or found me lacking in some way? But Mama and Papa were convinced it was the best match I could make. Two of the finest families in the two greatest countries in the world, united. When the photographs of Anthony Howard Stanton had arrived, Mama and Papa had expressed their approval while showing them to me.
"Darling, we think he looks most handsome and civilized."
I had taken them, barely able to keep my hands from shaking. Quickly I had placed them on my sewing table, so that the tremor might not be detected. Aged 22, Mr. Stanton was a good height, slim, and yes, he was handsome. Remarkably so. The rooms were small, but they looked clean. I waited by the door until Miss Adams confirmed her satisfaction and dismissed the proprietress. Miss Adams, I knew, was being paid handsomely to accompany me. A serious woman in her late 20s, she seemed to take no pleasure in anything. Her dress was plain to the point of severity, and her hair so tight as to be unflattering. She also had a long nose which, coupled with her all-seeing eyes, made her seem like a malevolent field mouse. I hoped I should be allowed to let her go once the wedding was over. As our boxes were delivered, Miss Adams busied herself with unpacking the things we might need for the night. I washed my hands and face, drying off on the hard towel on the washstand, catching my pale reflection in the spotted glass hanging above it. What had Mr. Stanton thought of my portraits? I had loathed sitting for the photographer, my head in a carefully concealed brace to keep it still, but Mama and Papa seemed very pleased with the result. He had captured my pale skin and large eyes so well, everyone said. I stared at the mirror, turning my head slowly left and right. My abundant hair was black like night, and shone as if it had been varnished. Piled up as it was, it gave the overall impression that my head was too heavy for my neck. Mama thought this appearance artful, along with some very tight corset lacing. All of it conspired to make me appear the merest slip of a thing, particularly at parties, where she often had my stays tightened by an extra 2 inches. And perhaps it had been worth it, for Mr. Stanton's proposal had come so soon after his receipt of the photographs. He had telegraphed my father the following day, and over the next hours my future had been tapped out in Morse code across thousands of miles at the cost of $1 a letter. At the memory, my chest tightened, and the walls suddenly seemed to be closing in on me. "Miss Adams, would you be so kind enough to loosen these stays, please? The room is not hot, I know, but it is so very airless." Her mousy face sharpened, but she unfastened the back of my dress and let out the stays, just a little. I took a deep, inelegant breath, dragging at the collar to free my throat and shoulders. "And might we open the window a little?" The manner in which she threw up the sash indicated she did not approve of this either. And perhaps she was right, as the air that came into the room was scarcely that of the purest kind. Still, it was cool, and there was a tang of the fresh wind we had experienced on our long journey over the Great Plains, first by rail, then by stagecoach. Papa and Mama were travelling separately, and had departed earlier in order to get to San Francisco early and finalise the wedding plans. The journey through Montana was our final leg, but the coming weeks were probably to be the most arduous, or so Mr. Goldsmith had warned me. The Indians were attacking all along the Bozeman Trail, and no one was safe. But on this route, he told me they were mostly unthreatening. And on the Oregon Trail, people were dying of a terrible disease, and that must be avoided at all costs. It was so bad, they were being buried under the trail itself, so that the wagons passing over them might break down their bodies very quickly and stop the wolves eating their bones. I looked over at the window, wanting to feel the breeze on my skin. After all day in the coach, I felt horribly trapped in the small room, but it would be indecorous to stand any closer to the window, where I might be seen, my pale shoulders exposed. It was then that I saw you. You were riding a white horse, spattered with large tan splotches. Your feet kicked out of the stirrups as you approached the hotel. Behind you trailed another horse on a rope. I had never seen anyone so at ease on horseback, and moved closer to the window. I hadn't yet seen your limp, nor your pale eyes, but I could see your longish brown hair and your unshaven jaw. Around your neck was a leather lace, from which dangled assorted objects. There seemed to be a knife, some feathers, with a few spent cartridges amongst them. You were squinting with fatigue, for the early evening spring sunshine was not bright. I hadn't noticed I'd take another step further toward the open window, fingers touching the frame. A rifle sat behind your right leg, stock sticking out of its sling, though I had become used to guns in my short time in America. I had seen more guns in the month since we arrived in New York than I had thought to exist in the entire world. You were dressed in long, soft Indian boots that laced around your legs, trousers, and a shirt with a battered suede waistcoat over it. I forgot about the strictures of my stays, captivated. You pulled the horses to a halt in the rutted dust by the hotel's hitching post and swung yourself down in the most graceful manner possible. As you slung the reins over the horses' heads and caressing them, I could see you were speaking to them, but in the noise leaking from the hotel and the clamour on the street, there was no way for me to hear what you were saying. As you moved to tie them to the rail, I saw the difficulty you had when out of the saddle. You were lame in the right leg. I watched as you handed the waiting hotel urchin a coin to keep an eye on the animals, and I was still standing there, staring when you looked up, your expression unreadable. My breath caught, and my heart began to thump as if it would jump out of my chest. From the window frame, my fingers lifted, then hesitated, uncertain. How long we stood there, I, to this day, have no idea. Miss Adams' cry of dismay pierced me. She ran forward, pulling me away and flinging the window down. Turning on me, her tirade was impressive.
Miss Forsyth, how could you expose yourself to such a man, to the whole street, undressed?
I put out my hands, pleading, yet I couldn't help but glance back at the window again.
I wished for only a moment or two of air. I had thought there was no harm in it. Please, do not tell Mama. I shall not behave in such a fashion again.
I stood, dress hanging from my shoulders. If Miss Adams did tell of what I had done, then I would be in considerable trouble, and Mama's disapproval was hard to endure, I thought quickly.
But if you were to write to Mama, of course, she would wonder why I had been left to my own devices.
Miss Adams' mouth closed like a man-trap. I said nothing more, but went over to the bed, fetching the travelling photograph frame containing my two photographs of the handsome, immaculately suited Mr. Stanton. Going to my nightstand, I opened the frame with a snap like a book and placed it where I should see it when I went to sleep and when I awoke, as had become my custom.
I should like to change before we eat. These clothes feel travel-stained, I said, presenting my back to her. She unfastened my dress, hands crueler than necessary. I made a mental note that as a married woman, I should very much like a lady's maid who did not pull me about and was considerate with the hairbrush. Worthy Miss Adams may have been. Gentle, she was not. Might we eat downstairs, do you think? I asked, as she finished buttoning my evening gown.
Amongst this kind of rabble? I think not. She sniffed.
I bit my lips together. Was I so transparent? Had I even admitted to myself I should like to catch a glimpse of you again? What was it about you that made me brave enough to request eating in a room full of men who terrified me? You were older than me, that much I guessed. It was hard to say how much older. Your tan, though undesirable in a civilized man, suited you. But you did look wild and dusty. The horses were still hitched to the post. You were down there somewhere. We ate in the room. The food was dreadful. Some sort of leathery pork steak with the obligatory beans. Owing to Father's entertaining duties for the embassy, our meals at home in London had frequently featured caviar, champagne jellies, and spun sugar confections. But I loved best Cook's little treats of an apple and cheese or a biscuit slipped onto my tray when Mama wasn't in the room. I placed my knife and fork together in silence. Miss Adams said nothing. Eating very little was ladylike, and she approved of ladylike behaviour. My travelling companion wasn't one for conversation, but as all she would have done would be to remind me of my lapse, I was grateful for the silence. So the interminable wait for the moment of retirement began. I had read all my books, and there were no more to be had at the hotel. Some had a small stock laid by, but Miss Adams had yet to find something suitable. The coach was to depart at dawn the following morning, so we were going to be up early. I stifled a feigned yawn. I doubted I would sleep. The wilder the territory became, the more fear crowded my thoughts, and it was worse at night. I shall prepare to retire, I think. I managed to snatch a glance out of the window as I passed. The white and brown horse was still there, waiting patiently, but alone. The next morning we were up and dressed before the sunrise. The stagecoach team were keen to cover the miles. We will be travelling long distances over the coming days and stopping only at staging posts. It was the remotest part of our journey, and not without its perils. Our guards were armed and taking no chances, as there were deserters and road agents to be found in the foothills of the mountains. When hearing of our plan to avoid the Oregon Trail, Mr. Stanton had written to tell me that his family's railway company were planning to scout out our route for a new branch of the Pacific Railroad. He asked me if I would be so kind and such a help to him as to make notes on the terrain, and any large bodies of water or mountains. Perhaps I might even sketch them. I ordered new pencils, watercolours, and sketchbooks so that I might be of use to my future husband. Outside at dawn, waiting to climb into the coach, I looked at the hitching post. The horse was gone, the street empty. Mr. Goldsmith, huge and forbidding in his great overcoat, appeared and opened the coach door, handing me in.
"Morning, miss,"
he said in his gruff manner, smelling somewhat of whiskey. "Good day." I settled into my seat, stays already digging into my hip bones. We left Helena and set out on a trail towards a place called Fort Shaw, hurrying, because soon the glacier high up in the mountains would experience the spring melt, which would make crossing all the rivers far more dangerous. Fort Shaw, according to the men I had heard talking when we stopped to water the horses, was little more than a military camp to keep the trail open. But there we would take on provisions and fresh horses. After that, we would branch west into the mountains. Indian Territory.
Chapter 2. "I can't believe we forgot the tea bags," Meredith said.
"I didn't forget them. I told you I didn't have room in my case."
"And you should eat something."
Please, Mum, I'm okay. Far beneath them, the great plains were spread out in the midday sun. Hope took the water bottle from the back of the seat pocket in front of her and chugged a gulp. The silence between them stretched out. Meredith hated it when Hope called her Mum, so Hope did it quite a lot. Meredith's idea of equality and feminism was that all women were on first-name terms. Hope's idea was that having a mum meant you got to call her Mum. The pilot announced that they would soon be starting their descent into Helena. Hope grabbed her wash bag and went to the back of the small aircraft. Inside the cramped space, the fluorescent light flickered as she threw the lock. She eyed her scruffy reflection like a wary stork. After a slow start, the last couple of years had added inches to her height, and Hope was still settling into being considerably taller than her neat little mother. A pair of khaki shorts, a white singlet, and a thin grey cardigan all hung from her, crumpled. There were violet smudges beneath her green eyes, and her freckled skin was washed out in the harsh light. Only her long, fair hair was full of life, streaming over her shoulders. The flush sucked out with a noisy whoosh and a blast of cold. She washed her face, brushed her teeth and her hair, and applied some lip balm. Then she was back in her seat as the seatbelt sign came on and the little plane lurched into its final descent. On the tarmac, the terminal building came into view. Long, low buildings in a solid grey surrounded a green, barn-like building with a pitched roof. The airport was tiny. Behind it, huge mountains rose up in the distance, almost lost in the haze of the spring day.
"Well, we're here,"
Meredith said brightly, as the cabin crew mobilised and the aircraft rolled to a halt.
"Great," Hope murmured under her breath.
Her mother shot her a look.
"At least give it a chance. How many people of your age get to travel like you?"
Hope gestured towards the window.
"A ranch? What am I going to do for a month on a ranch?"
She stood up and opened the overhead locker, pulling down her rucksack and shoving her wash bag inside it.
"If they don't have proper Wi-Fi and the movie channel, I'm going to die."
Meredith stood. "They told me they do, in the emails they sent me," she said.
"I asked especially. Though why you would want to fly 5,000 miles to one of the last great ecosystems in the world and spend your time watching Hollywood films, I just don't know."
"I didn't ask to come."
"You're 16, and you always come. It's one of the great advantages of homeschooling,"
Meredith said, tucking her short, sleek, dark hair behind her ears.
"And what are other girls your age doing? Hanging around in a park, drinking, taking drugs, messaging boys naked pictures of themselves?"
"I've never done that and I won't."
"Men only take advantage if you let them. You must use your personal agency as a woman to stop that happening."
Her mother tugged her handbag out of her cabin luggage, taking out a comb and running it over her head. Meredith disapproved of makeup. Hope slung her rucksack over her shoulder and looked down the gangway to where the few other passengers on the tin can plane were pulling on sweaters and retrieving their bags. The cabin door opened and sunshine flooded in. She gnawed her lip, arms folded.
"Will you just try and appreciate the time here? For me,"
her mum added.
"Who knows? It could be a real adventure."
They crossed the tarmac into the green terminal building. Inside, it was lofty and utilitarian, smelling vaguely of cinnamon-scented cleaning products. They queued for passport control and then waited in silence for their bags with the dozen other passengers, the carousel squeaking. Theirs was almost the last stuff to come through. Hope grabbed her large black nylon holdall, struggling with the weight. Meredith lifted her rolling case and popped up the handle efficiently. They went towards the exit and emerged into the terminal building.
There was a seating area and a bar called Captain Jack's. Meredith came to a halt, Hope just behind her.
He said he'd be here, she said slowly, scanning the terminal.
Who?
Caleb Crowe.
Hope raised an eyebrow. Caleb? Sounds like a Mormon.
No, he's a hugely respected rancher.
And he has no religious affiliations as far as I know. I told him what we looked like.
Hope wasn't listening.
She was staring at a tall boy wearing jeans, plain brown leather boots, and a checkered shirt with the sleeves rolled above his elbows. He was on his phone with his weight slightly on one leg, shrugging as he talked and scanned the stragglers. Everything about him was narrow and angular. His hips, his chest, his throat. He had bright blue eyes, shiny brown hair pushed off his face, a sharp jaw, and tanned skin that looked slightly dusty. Hope had never seen anything like him. She knew she was staring as she began to revise her expectations of Montana very sharply upwards. He caught her gaze and stopped talking. There was a long second before the person on the other end of the line gained his attention again, as Hope and the young cowboy stared at each other. He ended the call and walked towards them. Hope looked away, embarrassed to have been caught gawping, and hoping he wasn't going to try and talk to her, while wanting more than anything in the world for him to come over. But it always went badly if a boy tried to talk to her in front of Meredith. She looked at the floor, just as a pair of well-worn leather boots appeared.
"Mrs. West?"
asked a clear and very American voice.
"He's here for us. Oh, God, please, please let him be here for us. Maybe he works for the ranch. Oh, God!"
"It's Dr. West, actually."
Meredith's voice was cool.
"Ah, sorry, ma'am. Of course, Dr. West," he said seriously.
She raised an eyebrow.
"We were expecting Caleb Crowe."
He offered a tanned hand.
"You've got him, ma'am. We're both Caleb, me and Dad. I'm Cal, for the sake of all our sanities."
They shook. "This is my daughter, Hope." Cal turned to her. He radiated health and athleticism. Hope felt even more exhausted. His dry, calloused grip enveloped her hand. He shook once, then let her go.
"Hey there," he said, not quite meeting her eyes. "Let me take your bag."
He stooped and put his hand on the black strap of her holdall.
"We only bring what we can carry ourselves," Meredith said. "We can manage."
Cal removed the bag from Hope's hands without trying, straightening up.
"Sure, you can. But now you don't have to."
Turning, he took the handle of Meredith's case and began to drag it behind him, loping off towards the bright glass doors of the terminal. Meredith took a deep breath.
"Well, he seems very nice," she said.
"Chauvinism aside,
but this is the Midwest, I suppose. Still living in a different century."
They followed him out into the fresh air. Hope took a deep breath and looked around. Cal was stowing their bags in the flatbed of a vintage white Ford pickup. It was huge. He walked to the passenger door and opened it. Hope looked at him, and he gestured inside. There was room for three. A rifle was strapped into the rear window. She held back, looking at it and the Spartan interior. Meredith climbed in, busying herself with fastening the lap belt. Hope sighed, not wanting to be cramped up again. Her limbs hadn't started to loosen from a day's flying and waiting around in JFK, then Salt Lake City.
"It's really not too far to home," Cal said in his steady, light drawl, as if reading her mind.
Hope looked at him. He met her gaze, his eyes an even brighter blue in the sunshine. She bit her lip on a smile. Somewhere nearby, a bird was singing. It swooped low above them, its wings a stunning blue. He watched it whip through the air, disappearing over the long-term car park, song fading out.
"Was that a Montana bluebird?" Meredith called from inside the pickup, startling them out of their shared moment.
"Astonishing to see one so close to an airport."
"Yes, Dr. West," Cal replied. "Must have heard you were coming."
Hope swore he shot her the ghost of a wink. She got into the pickup, pushing her holdall into the footwell, and he closed the door behind her. They skirted the edges of Helena, driving down a long boulevard with low buildings on either side. Traffic lights hung on arched gantries over the tarmac junctions. Gaudy signs for stores and restaurants clustered by the side of the road. There were the golden arches, and a huge plastic pig was advertising a ribs shack. A drab motel had only a few cars outside. Hope stared out of the window as Meredith attempted to make conversation.
"So, Cal, how far are we going?"
They were at a stop signal. He shifted in the seat a little, his elbow out of the window, and a long body lax in the seat.
"Not too far. It's just a few hours."
Hope's heart sank, but she stayed looking out of the window.
"We need to swing by Fort Shaw and collect a few things from the store."
Meredith nodded.
"Well, thank you for meeting us. It's very kind. It would have been such a nuisance to hire a car just to get to the ranch and back."
He shrugged.
"A pleasure. And like I said in the email, there is plenty of vehicles you can use back at home, so pointless to get a rental for one journey."
The light changed, and they moved forwards. Hope wound down her window, wanting the breeze on her face.
"I thought it was your father in the emails," Meredith admitted.
"Did you?" He sounded surprised.
"No, it was always me. Dad's not big on email. Not even sure he would know how to use it. The only thing he looks at on the computer is the weather forecast and the price of feed."
"I'm very much looking forward to seeing the ranch. I've heard a great deal about the ecosystem you've managed to maintain. I think it will be invaluable for my research." He nodded.
"The ranch goes back a long way in the family. The first deeded acres we have are from 1871. We've worked hard over the years to keep everything as natural as we can. We don't use any pesticides and we cultivate as little as possible. It's a working ranch, though," he said after a pause. "Not much glamour about it."
The way he spoke was slow compared to Londoners. Hope carried on looking out of the window, breathing in the fresh air. The buildings were thinning out.
"I respect that, and thank you for letting us stay with you. We don't need glamour, do we, Hope?"
Meredith said. Hope shook her head, looking at her hands.
"Hope's rather shy, as you can see."
"Great, thanks, Mum. The hottest boy ever, and you're making me out to be a massive loser already."
He said nothing, just indicated to turn on to a different road, a two-lane highway stretching into the distance, dead straight. On one side were the mountains, on the other, the plains stretched away. As they drove, Meredith questioned him. His answers were economical, but not unfriendly.
"Yes, I'm 19.
"Which college are you attending?"
"I'm not at college, Dr. West."
"Oh, are you taking a gap year?" Hope sighed internally and let her head rest against the doorframe. There was a long pause.
"I didn't graduate high school."
Hope sensed, rather than saw, him look sideways at her mother. She also sensed the judgment coming from Meredith, who thought that higher education was the meaning of life.
Hope leant against the ribbed white enamel of the door and stared out at the landscape. Ahead of them, by the side of the road, was a tall, metal-clad building, almost like a tower with no windows. Around it were other towers, but round. They looked ghostly and abandoned. Parts of the metal cladding were falling away.
"What's that, please?"
Hope asked, trying to lighten the atmosphere. He looked across at her for a moment, surprised by the sound of her voice.
"Grain elevator. Storage. That one's not been used in a while."
"It looks like a lot around here hasn't been used in a while," Hope said, feeling the colour rise in her cheeks, unsure of why she was even still speaking.
"Yeah, we've suffered a little with the economy. Depopulation, stuff like that."
Coming up on their left was a small fenced-off square. Inside, old wooden crosses mingled with the odd headstone. In front of one were artificial flowers in a jam jar. Hope leant a little to keep it in view and realized as the square passed behind the driver's side window that she was looking straight at Cal. She sat back, letting her hair fall in her face.
"Do you study, Hope?"
Hope looked at her hands in her lap, thumbs locked together around her empty water bottle, as her mother answered for her.
"Hope is homeschooled, and we're still discussing what she will study at university. A vocational or science degree is best. It's very difficult for arts graduates to find work in the UK at the moment."
He drove one-handed, putting his free hand on the roof rail at the top of the door outside.
"Well, our vocation's ranching. What's your vocation, Hope?"
"Writing. I want to be a writer, more than anything."
Hope took a breath to speak, the words seemingly stuck in her throat.
"Hope will study a science, probably chemistry," Meredith said,
and no one spoke much after that. They drove on. At one point, they passed a low, dirty house with smoke coming from the single chimney. Scattered around it were more than a dozen old buses and trucks, their shapes familiar to Hope from old movies. Rusting and collapsing into the scrubby prairie, they looked like a herd of decrepit animals. A phone buzzed somewhere. Cal pulled it out of his pocket and looked at it for a second before putting it back. Hope was annoyed at herself for wanting to know who was getting in touch with him. She pulled out her own phone and checked her text messages.
"Is the roaming turned off?"
Meredith asked for the 10th time. Hope stared out of the window. The landscape was changing again, with bigger dips and rolls, and to the right was a group of old wooden buildings. The land around them was cultivated, and there was a group of women working in a field, weeding with long-handled hoes. Their clothes were brightly coloured, consisting of a pinafore dress and flat leather shoes. On their heads were black, white-spotted kerchiefs. Cal saw her watching them with interest.
"They're the Hutterites, kind of like Amish. No cars, no electricity, nothing modern. Came from Germany in the 19th century. Settled all over these parts and up into Canada. Folks round here call them the Hoots. They farm, mostly."
"This terrain is rather inhospitable to traditional arable agriculture, isn't it?" Meredith asked, gesturing out to the scrubby plant covering the miles of untended land.
"That's sagebrush, I think. Very hardy." "Yeah. We got about 16 types. It grows where other things won't. And yeah, the land isn't great. Lot of failed homesteaders around here back in the last century. Ranchers generally aren't keen on little farms breaking up the land, and farmers tend not to like waking up to a load of cattle trampling their fields. But the Hutterites, they work crazy hard. And land is all they have."
A red sign on the side of the road informed them they had arrived in Fort Shaw. It was a small town with one main street. There was an old military cemetery with a white sign proclaiming it dated from 1867. Cal halted the pickup outside a white wooden shack with an ancient Pepsi sign sticking out of it, next to a faded silver convertible. Sitting under the shaded porch, humming, was a white refrigerator as ancient as the sign, with a glass front containing beers and sodas and a large mongrel dog. A sign on the door behind the dog read, "Open."
"I'll be just a moment."
Cal got out and went to the door, stepping over the dog and going inside. Meredith and Hope sat in silence.
"Apparently, lots of young Americans don't graduate high school. It's a shame, but we mustn't let that affect our judgment of him."
Hope resisted the urge to say that she hadn't judged him at all.
"Look," Meredith's tone softened. "I know you're shy, but it would be nice if you tried just a little harder."
"I'm going to take this opportunity to use the loo. Coming?" Hope shook her head. Meredith got out of the pickup on the driver's side and went through a door that said, "Restroom, patrons only," just next to the shop. Hope watched the street. Cal reappeared, a case of wine under each arm. He hooked the door open with his foot and stepped back over the dog. He put the wine in the flatbed and disappeared again, coming out a few seconds later with a vast bag of something slung over his shoulder. The pickup bounced a little as he dropped it into the back. He went back to the store, pulling money from the rear pocket of his jeans, elbow sharp behind him. He stood in the doorway, talking to a bulky American Indian man as he handed over the money. Hope listened to him as they talked.
"Nah, thanks anyway, though. 250, right?"
"Yep. 220 for the wine and 30 for the dog food. I swear Buddy is sponsored by the pet food people. The amount he eats. Thanks."
He took the cash.
"Send my best to your parents."
"Will do. Thanks, Joe. You guys coming up next weekend?"
The store owner grinned as he tucked the money away.
"Wouldn't miss a Crow barbecue after all this time. And we're looking forward to meeting your visitors."
He waved towards the pickup. Hope lifted her hand and smiled. Coming towards the pickup on the quiet street was another truck, newer and shinier. It sped up as it got closer, engine loud and music pumping. The driver's window was down, and as it passed, shouts and jeers came from the blacked-out interior, and a large plastic cup smashed against Hope's side of the pickup, exploding in a spray of ice and watery coke. She recoiled as the truck drove away, music fading as it turned the corner. Cal jumped down, leaning in the driver's side window.
"You okay?"
Hope brushed a couple of splashes from her shoulder.
"Yes, thanks. Friendly locals."
He was scowling, looking after the truck.
"Local idiots," the man called Joe said. "Sorry about that, miss."
Hope shrugged, unsettled, as a tall American Indian woman in jeans, a tight T-shirt, and a gun in a shoulder holster walked out of the store, letting the door bang behind her. On her belt was a police badge. Her narrow eyes were focused down the street, where the truck had disappeared. Cal took a bottle of water from the noisy refrigerator, just as a police cruiser slid to a halt right in front of the pickup's nose. Two men got out. Both were large and intimidating. Their belts bristled with batons, handcuffs, and firearms. Cal's pace, returning to the vehicle, slowed.
"What now?"
Hope heard him say under his breath.
"Well, well, young Caleb Crow," the older man said.
He
He wore mirrored sunglasses on his craggy face, and his uniform looked more senior than the young man's. He had muscular arms he folded over his chest. Joe came back onto the porch of the shop, and the dog lifted its head, suddenly alert. The tall woman stuck her hands in her back pockets and watched, her glossy shoulder-length hair caught by the breeze.
"Chief Hart, Officer Jones," Cal said politely, with a slight nod.
Despite the man's sunglasses, Hope knew his gaze had shifted to her. She ducked her head.
"What have we got here?"
The chief sauntered over to the rolled-down driver's window and stooped to look in at Hope.
"Hello, miss. You from out of town?"
"Hello. Yes, I am."
"Listen to that pretty accent. You English?"
"Yes."
He straightened up, speaking to Cal again. The other officer was standing intimidatingly close.
"You gotta go some distance these days to make sure they ain't heard your reputation, don't you, son?"
Cal's face was impassive, but Hope saw his hand tighten around the water bottle. The chief saw it too.
"Ah, now, boy, don't get riled. I ain't gonna tell her what a no-good piece of shit you really are."
He bent to the window again, looking in at Hope.
"Now, miss, you take real good care of yourself around this boy, okay? He ain't to be trusted. Enjoy your stay here in our fine county."
He slapped the door of the pickup, then his eyes shifted to the flatbed in the back, seeing the wine. A triumphant smirk spread across his face.
"Now, would that there be alcohol I see you just purchased from our upstanding ethnic storekeeper here in town?"
Cal said nothing, and Hope suddenly remembered that the legal age for drinking in America was 21. Cal was underage. Joe's expression was unreadable, but Hope could feel the tension in the air. The policeman walked back to where his fellow officer was standing, almost toe-to-toe with Cal.
"Looks like I got me an open-and-shut case. Shame to close down these fine stores, but I ain't got no choice. Can't condone the selling of alcohol to Montana's minors."
Cal didn't move, his jaw set. Joe said nothing.
"Knew I'd get you in the end, Black. Just a matter of time. Your kind just ain't good around liquor, are you?"
"He was collecting an order," the tall woman interrupted, knocking a cigarette out of a soft packet. "That's all." She and the policeman stared at each other for a long time, his eyes unreadable behind the glasses.
"No one asked you, officer," he said. "So I suggest you get along to the res and do whatever it is you do there."
The woman lit the cigarette. "No business there today. Business here," she said around it. His face hardened further.
"This place is under my care. You remember that."
"I remember," she said placidly. Meredith came out of the restroom. "Is there a problem, officers? We've only parked here for a few moments so I could use the conveniences. I'm sorry, we've just come from the airport and I was quite insistent." The police chief nodded in her direction.
"Ma'am, I'm afraid we have an incident of the sale of alcohol by Mr. Black to young Mr. Crow here. There are serious penalties for that in this state."
Meredith didn't even blink. "Alcohol? Do you mean the wine?"
"Yes, ma'am, I do."
"Oh, but I purchased it. We're here for a month, you see, and I do like a glass of wine at the end of the day." Hope breathed a sigh of relief. The police chief looked seriously disappointed, almost as if he was grinding his teeth. The tall woman was trying not to smile.
You got a receipt?
I'm afraid not. I paid in cash, so I didn't take one. $220. After a pause, the police chief spoke again.
Then there is no problem at all, ma'am. I'd like to welcome you and your daughter to Montana. You take good care of her out at that ranch.
There was a silence. Meredith refused to fill it, her face hardening at the mention of Hope.
Because, you know, anything could happen.
He finished. With that, both men turned, got back into the police cruiser, taking their time, and the car lumbered off. Hope looked down, wishing she were as brave as her mother. Meredith got back into the pickup through Cal's door, sliding across the seat and buckling her belt. Cal eased back into the pickup and turned the key.
I'm obliged to you, Dr. West.
He looked out of the window.
You too, officer.
The tall woman threw down the end of her cigarette and stamped on the stub, then turned and left with a small nod in his direction. Meredith clicked the seatbelt fastener. Not at all. I loathe men throwing their weight around.
How did you know how much it cost?
Cal looked genuinely bemused. Meredith shook her head. Have you heard the acoustics in that bathroom? You can hear every word that's said right outside the store. Dreadful. I hope it doesn't work the other way round. Hope hid a smile, as did Cal.
Still, thanks again. Joe could have been in real trouble.
Yes, so I imagine, as could you. But we'll say no more about it. And I'd far rather have the wine than not. Hope sat listening in silence.
It's not far now, I promise,
Cal said, leaning across and holding out the bottle of water to Hope.
We live off Highway 89.
She looked at the water, surprised, before taking it. He said nothing about what had just happened, but there were stripes of red high on his brown cheekbones. He turned off onto a single-track road and stopped the pickup, jumping out and checking a sturdy white mailbox on a post, emblazoned on the front with broken bit, and beneath the words, Oroy Plata. Gold and silver. Montana's state motto. Hope had learnt from a cursory check of Wikipedia when Meredith had announced the tickets were booked. A bundle of envelopes in his hand, Cal got back into the vehicle and drove on, heading for the mountain range to the west. The land rose in waves. Stands of trees clumped here and there, and rocks dotted the landscape. After a short while, they passed beneath the huge wooden arch, seemingly fashioned from massive scavenged tree branches, burnt repeatedly with a motif Hope hadn't seen before. The sign that hung from it held only one word in rusted iron letters, Crow. What does the burnt symbol mean, please? Hope asked.
It's our brand, for the livestock and the horses. Broken Bit Ranch. Everyone puts theirs on their gatepost round here, if they're ranching. Ours is a little unusual. It's a broken D-ring snaffle bit, hence the name of the ranch. But it's also two C's turned to face each other.
He curled his thumbs and forefingers to face each other in the shape of two letter C's on top of the steering wheel.
Crow and Caleb. We're all Caleb. I'm the fifth.
Post and rail fencing appeared. Cattle dotted the landscape. I thought your ranch was horses, Meredith said.
It is. The finest American horses,
he said matter-of-factly, glancing across at Hope.
But we also raise pedigree cattle.
Rare breeds that are under threat. It's a family thing. We have buffalo here, too. We're one of the original 5 families who saved them from extinction back in the 19th century. We've been here for almost 150 years, kept the ranch intact through the fence wars, the Depression. My great-grandma kept it going, while my great-granddaddy was a prisoner in the Pacific during World War II. All the time we've been working on bringing back the buffalo. Still trying to even out the gene pool with them. Cattle are detrimental to the delicate environmental balance you've got here. There was a note of accusation in Meredith's voice. We keep an eye on it, he said mildly. We have to manage the cattle and the buffalo separately on the land anyway, because of the disease risk. The pickup raised a dust cloud behind it as they headed further up the track. When they had been driving for some time, a group of red-roofed buildings appeared, nestling into the edge of a forest. In front of them were corrals, where groups of horses gathered in the corners, quiet in the afternoon sun. They arrived at the cluster of buildings. Hope looked up at the house. The central building was huge, constructed from timber and stone, and looked like a cross between a barn and a cathedral, with a wide porch wrapped around all sides. The bleached boards had long since faded to silvery grey, and it had a timeless frontier feeling about it. Above the vast front door was the skull of a cow or a bull, with gigantic horns. A tall, lean man came out of a large and much-repaired stable barn and walked towards them. He was almost exactly like Cal, just older.
Meredith? Hope?
He held out his hand.
Caleb Crowe. Hope the drive wasn't too long after your journey.
Meredith shook. Not at all, Mr. Crowe. Thank you. Caleb shook Hope's hand, too.
Well, Miss Hope, this is a real pleasure.
Caleb Crowe Sr. had a stronger accent than his son.
A real treat to have your pretty face around the place.
Meredith's expression cooled. Cal hauled their bags out of the pickup.
You going to show these girls to their quarters?
Yep. Caleb gestured for them to follow his son. They walked up the steps, onto the porch, and then into the cool, wooden house. Beyond the door was a huge room right up into the roof. More horned cattle skulls adorned the rafters. Battered leather sofas were covered with throws in Indian patterns. Hung on one wall was a flat TV. Through a wooden archway beyond was a bright, clean kitchen. This way. Cal tipped his head towards an exposed spiral staircase, all wood and glass. At that moment, a leggy bundle of grey and white fur hurtled into the room, banging into Cal's leg.
Hey, buddy!
Hope started back. There was what appeared to be a grey wolf in the room. Cal pushed the creature away affectionately.
We'll get you something to eat in a minute.
The wolf bounded up to Hope, planting both his huge paws on her chest. She stumbled back, clutching the strap of her holdall.
Buddy, Cal snapped. Where are your manners?
The animal retreated instantly, tail wagging.
Sorry,
Cal said, rubbing the side of the wolf's head against his thigh.
He's just a baby.
A baby wolf? Hope asked uncertainly.
Nah, well, half. He's a cross with some kind of domestic breed. Probably a stray. They call them wolf dogs. I found him last year, near a dumpster on the edge of Fort Shaw, when he was just a few days old.
Meredith moved closer, fascinated.
He seems more wolf than dog,
but very tractable. Is his behavior consistent? Cal shrugged.
We've never had any problems with him. I'll show you your accommodation.
Upstairs, he walked along a balcony which overlooked the huge sitting room. Pushing open a door with his toe, he put Meredith's bag inside.
Dr. West, you're in here.
Hope's mother turned, frowning. We're not in the same room. Cal hesitated.
We thought you'd like your own space.
We would, we do, Hope said quickly. Meredith backed away and walked into her brightly decorated room, saying nothing. On a trip away, they had never slept separately before. Cal led Hope to another door along the balcony. The room behind it was massive, like everything in the house. The back wall was all glass, looking out over the bluff and forest at the back of the house. A white cowhide covered the wooden floor. On a table was a television and a computer. The door was open to a shower room. He put her bag on the bed.
I didn't know if you were bringing your own laptop or...
Yes, but thank you, Hope said, grateful.
Is there anything you need? More water or anything?
He stuck a hand in his back pocket and gestured over his shoulder with the other thumb in the vague direction of downstairs. She shook her head. They watched each other for a few moments. Hope struggled to breathe normally.
Okay, we eat around 7.
He closed the door behind him.
Chapter 3. To love and to hate, then, seem to be the two things which it is most natural and most easy for women to do. How important is it, therefore, that they should learn early in life to love and hate aright? It had taken us another 3 days to do what did not seem like so very many miles. The staging posts had been tolerable, although I hadn't been able to manage much sleep, and the arrangements often left a lot to be desired. Still, we were making progress. Mostly the track that passed for a road was hard and reliable. In Fort Shaw we slept in a military tent, but I had managed to find some new books and newspapers to pass the time, given to me by an army captain's wife, who had proved very kind and a welcome change from Miss Adams. There had also been a large family there, intending to settle in the area. Their clothing was plain but brightly coloured, and the women wore pretty handkerchiefs on their hair covered with dots. There were 2 girls around my age, and I attempted to speak to them. They would not talk to me, only turned away in silence without meeting my eyes. I learnt later that they were very religious and do not speak to the people who are not like them. As we set out from yet another staging post that morning, I opened my book, already vetted by my companion, and began to read. The day passed, sunny and fine. When I wasn't reading, I looked out of the window at the ever more dramatic scenery and attempted to draw in my sketchbook. The air was thin and cool, and I breathed in as much as I could. The ends of the steel stays of my long corsets, even though they were covered with padded material, were wearing red welts on my hip bones and the ribs of my back. I had worn for most of my life corsets stiffened with cane or whalebone, but Mama had taken a notion that a steel-strengthened corset was a way to proper posture. Underneath one shoulder blade, it had broken the skin. Miss Adams had applied a stinging salve to it the previous evening. I knew she could not fail to notice the other marks, but she said nothing, and had laced me up just as tightly that morning. When I asked if I might travel in a looser, shorter set, she refused. Apparently, Mama had told her that upon my arrival I should be straight into the smartest of San Franciscan society, and I must not let myself down with a sloppy figure. Accustomed as I was to being constrained, the days had become very painful, and more than once I had to hide a tear whilst waiting to dress in the mornings, facing yet another day of imprisonment. We met few people on the trail, and the team had seen or heard little regarding the whereabouts of the Indian tribes. Supposedly,
It was common for bands of the young men, sometimes as few as two, but other times as many as 24, to roam the country, whilst the others stayed in one place. According to Mr. Goldsmith, who had travelled this trail more than once, some of the local Indians were even farmers, and did not use horses much, although others lived almost their entire lives on horseback. The horseback tribes, Mr. Goldsmith told me, were great hunters of the buffalo, of which we had seen so many on the plains on the way here. Thousands, in such multitudes it was hard to imagine before seeing them. I had smelt them from the train window. The bulls, as they were called, were gigantic, far more massive than even the largest of the London dray horses. Abundance seemed to be everywhere here in America. Once the train had followed an astonishing migration of birds. Pigeon, Mr. Goldsmith said. So many we were with them for hours, and they darkened the sky above us. And it was not only the animals that caught my attention. Here and there we had seen Indians, all on horseback, usually sitting stock still and watching the train passing. Now we were heading through the country of the southern tribe, whose name I could not spell, towards the Blackfoot territory, before skirting the edge of the Flathead's land. Part of me quaked in fear at the idea that we would encounter Indians. But now I know another part of me wanted an adventure before we reached San Francisco. I did not know at that moment, of course, what an adventure I would have. My eyes stayed on the page, but lost their focus as I thought about my new life. Before we had separated at Portsmouth, Mama had given Miss Adams a pamphlet that I was to read on the crossing about wifely duties. I suspect she thought that, had I read it before leaving Portman Square, I may not have boarded that steamship. It spoke only of duty and tolerance. My tolerance, that is. Tolerance towards what was expressed as my marital duties and my husband's natural physical needs. I had no knowledge of what form this tolerance was to take, or what physical part I might play in it. I regretted that Mama had not given me the pamphlet herself, so that I might have been able to ask her, but I also guessed that this was precisely what she had been trying to avoid. There were, I knew, issues of some delicacy surrounding private married life. I just wished I knew what they were. Mama and I had shared a bedroom all my life. Papa had suggested the year before that I might take one of the other 6 bedrooms, but Mama had refused, saying she required my company. He lived in a different wing of the house, and the only physical thing I had ever seen my parents do together was walk into dinner, my mother's hand on my father's arm. Miss Adams proved herself once again no great help by staunchly refusing to discuss the pamphlet's existence after handing it over to me. The coach slowed. Mr. Goldsmith leant down from his perch on the roof.
"Bridge, ladies?"
His disembodied voice said somewhere above the open window. It was customary for the driver to halt the coach before a bridge, whilst one of the team jumped down and inspected it for soundness. Then we would proceed with some caution. Many of the bridges on this remote trail were over a decade old and were wanting repair. I tried to see out of the window, but Miss Adams's look of reproach meant I sat back again in my seat and turned my eyes to my book. I listened, though, as the teamster returned and spoke to the driver in his American brogue.
"Looks fine. A few planks out further along, but it doesn't look like it'll cause any trouble. It's just a gulch, runoff for the glacier."
The man retook his position next to the driver, and the coach lumbered forward. I studied my book. Despite my vague longing for an adventure, the bridges often frightened me. Crossing them was perilous. Most of them were only just wide enough for the coach, and took all of the skill of the driver to keep them on the rails. Fortunately, our team had come out of Chicago, and had over 20 years' experience. A Mr. Pinkerton had recommended them to Papa personally. My thoughts returned to you, and the long moment we had seen each other at the hotel. Your image remained fixed in my mind. The day had turned somewhat warm. I found my fan and opened it, directing cooler air onto my face as I read and drew, trying to ignore my aching hip bones and my sore back.
I do not know what you read that makes you so overly heated, Miss Adams said sarcastically. I looked at her, unable to keep the color rising in my face. She knew well, after all, what I was reading.
It is some poetry of Mr. Dryden's.
Poetry is a waste of time, which no wife-to-be should meddle with.
I thought about that as the coach hauled itself onto the bridge and began the slow crawl forwards. Mr. Stanton has written to me particularly kindly regarding my own interests, which he is keen I should keep up, I said at last. Miss Adams raised an eyebrow.
You will learn soon enough, Miss Forsyth, that what men say and what they intend are two different things.
What do you mean, please?
I asked, curiosity getting the better of me. Indiscretion, or passion, had clearly got the better of her. She was florid, her nose positively agitated. Men are jades, Miss Forsyth. They will say and do anything to have their will satisfied, liars and cheats all. You should no more expect to love than to hate your husband.
Have you ever been married?
My voice was small. The fever in her voice was so hot.
No, and no more would I marry than I would fly to the moon, she said, angry.
The coach came to a halt, and the silence hung heavily between us. The men were having a discussion.
Why not?
I asked at last.
Because I see no reason to put myself in harm's way more than absolutely necessary, and I prefer to get my own bread than to put myself under a man's control, with their disgusting lechery and filthy habits.
Papa was not a man of filthy habits. He was always immaculately dressed, with a boiled and starched collar. A man came to shave him and make his hands elegant each weekday, and I wasn't sure what lechery meant. I had a dictionary, but Mama had inked out many words. There was a huge bang. The coach lurched to one side, throwing us across the interior. The horses began to scream. I struggled into a sitting position at what had been the left-hand wall of the coach. Out of the window, I saw, far below us, the dry river bed. I could see the dusty boulders and stones there in perfect detail. I could also see both teamsters lying broken against the rubble. From one of their heads, that of the younger one, spread a darkening pool. The driver was still on board, cradled in his sturdy seat. Mr. Goldsmith, too, it seemed, had managed to cling on to the roof rail.
Ladies, brace yourselves as best you can and hang on tight. Driver's going to try and whip us out of this.
There was another enormous bang, and the coach slid sideways again. The horses were still screaming, and their voices mixed with my own as the coach, with deafening creaking and cracking, began to fall towards the riverbed. Reaching up, I grabbed onto the other door, wanting to put as much space between myself and the ground as possible. I heard an inhuman howl, and saw Miss Adams clawing at her face as through the opposite window the riverbed rushed up to meet us. Filling my compressed lungs as best I could, I screamed at the injustice of the world.
Chapter 4. Hope took a long shower. When she came out, wrapped in a towel, hair hanging in damp straps over her shoulders, the puppy was on her bed, tongue lolling in its sharp face. She halted. From somewhere in the house, Cal's voice bellowed. Buddy, where are you? You loser! Get down here! The dog scrambled over Hope's pile of dirty clothes and shot out of the door, a scrap of white cotton in his mouth. Hope hurtled after him, out to the landing. He was already down the stairs, crossing the huge room to where Cal stood, staring up at Hope as she clutched the towel to her chest. The dog sat obediently and presented his gift. What you got there? Hey, pal? Cal tore his gaze from Hope, reached down and took the offering, before realizing what it was. He looked at his hand, brows drawing together as he tried to think of something to say. He opened his mouth to speak, just as Meredith's door opened, Cal snatched his hand behind his back. Hey, Dr. West, how you doing up there?
Meredith looked between them.
Perfectly well, thank you. Hope, is there something you need?
No, I just... nothing.
She went back into her room, kicked the door shut, and leant against it, closing her eyes and biting back a groan of despair. 15 minutes later, she was getting dressed in another pair of shorts, another vest, and a Gap hoodie. Hope? Her mother said through the door.
Yes?
I thought I'd take a look around. Would you like to come with me? Hope bit her lips together.
Not really, no. I'd like a convenient hole to crawl into.
But she knew from Meredith's tone she was telling, not asking.
Okay, just a second, I need shoes.
She ducked back into the room and shoved her feet into some canvas espadrilles. Coming back to the landing, she tugged the door shut. They went through the house and outside to the front. There was no one to be seen. But there was a sense of constant, low-level activity in the air. From a large, plain building behind the barn, voices drifted. Meredith and Hope went to investigate. Caleb Crowe was standing, hands on his hips and hat pulled over his eyes, watching as his son rode a glossy black horse in a tight figure of eight on the sawdust floor of the building. Cal wore a pair of suede coverings over his jeans, tight around his lower legs and fastening just beneath the knee, and a pair of battered leather gloves with gaping cuffs showing off his tanned wrists. Concentrating on the horse, he didn't even seem aware of their arrival.
Hey, ladies, Caleb Crowe said. Settling in?
Meredith nodded. Thank you. He watched the horse, distracted.
That's great. We're not used to paying guests here. You'll have to cut us some slack.
Everything is perfect so far, thank you. It's very kind of you to put us up at all.
Couldn't hardly refuse when you said we had all these things you need to study, could we?
He put his head on one side.
Cal, he looks tied in the hocks to me. Could just be the time he spent in the trailer. Back him up. Feel him out a little.
Cal brought the horse to an instant halt and bumped his heels gently as he lifted the reins a notch. The horse began to walk backwards towards them.
He's just stiff. Nothing a stretch won't cure.
Speaking of which, we'd like to take a walk too, Meredith said. Is there a particular direction we should go?
Well, you can go in any direction you like, for a long time. But if you head on up there,
he pointed to the trees,
you'll hit a forest trail. Your feet might not be up to going too far in those shoes, though, Miss Hope.
He looked at her Toms. Hope should eat something, Meredith said, before we go anywhere.
Cal?
Yeah?
The little lady's hungry.
No problem. He jumped down and drew the reins over the horse's head.
Please, it's fine, really, Hope said quickly.
Cal halted, glove on the bridle.
You want something or not?
His tone was blunt, but not unfriendly.
Can't we just go for a walk, please, Mum?
Hope pleaded. Meredith's lips thinned. She stalked out of the barn, up towards the forest between the stable barn and the house. Hope followed, ducking past Cal, who was still holding on to the black horse's bridle, watching her. As soon as they entered the cool green of the forest, her mother slowed. I'm going to pretend I didn't see what I saw in the house. He seems a nice young man, and I must admit he's remarkably handsome, but...
Nothing happened! I was standing on the landing 6 meters away from him. Barely covered.
Why?
New craze. Shower burlesque.
Don't be smart. as much as you don't want to hear it, I've experienced sexual attraction too.
Oh my God.
Hope wrapped her hands in her hair.
Please, please stop talking.
Just because I'm your mother doesn't mean I've never had a sex life. In the car, you told me to try harder, Hope said, her feet crunching on the pine needles. Trying harder doesn't mean parading around their house in a towel.
I wasn't parading.
I've raised you to make good, sensible choices, Hope, and that wasn't one of them. Hope said nothing. Above them, the forest was alive with birdsong and the occasional flutter of wings. As sunlight shot through the canopy, softening in the late afternoon, it lit up insects and the odd butterfly. The trail turned back towards the ranch and suddenly spilt them out onto the meadow at the back of the house. I have some work I should get on with, her mother said, suddenly seeming weary as they headed into the kitchen through open sliding glass doors. What are you going to do?
Check my emails, maybe.
Do it sitting in a chair so you don't fall asleep. We need to make it through until at least 10 tonight. Try that chemistry project. Back in her bedroom, Hope unpacked her laptop and put it next to the router, taking the password from the sticker on the top of the blue plastic. Her emails downloaded, and she sent a message to her friend Lauren to let her know they had arrived. It was after midnight back at home. Clicking through Facebook, she hesitated before updating her status with "In Montana." Because of the travelling and being so shy, her social life wasn't exactly anything to shout about. At least on Facebook, she didn't get tongue-tied. Curious, she searched for Cal's unusual name, but with no luck. Then she felt weird and stalky and blinked, tired. Putting the computer to sleep, she got to her feet and stretched. Heading down the stairs, she crossed to the front door and went back out into the sunshine. The horses had shifted further away now, tails swishing as they lazed. The pickup had moved over to a cluster of buildings to her left, but the only sounds were coming from the stable barn to the right. Hope wandered over to it and went in through the gigantic hangar-like doors. Her eyes took a few seconds to adjust to the dimness. Down each side were stalls and some contained horses. One large dark brown animal had its head hanging over the door. It watched Hope as she approached, its liquid brown eye on her. Its head shifted slightly, and Hope held up her hand and very carefully touched the horse's face. It allowed the caress, so Hope's fingers slid to its nose. The skin was like velvet and prickled with thick whiskers. She stroked cautiously down its face again. Then suddenly it dipped its head and butted her hard in the chest, sending her stumbling backwards into something solid. A pair of arms closed around her, and she yelped in surprise.
Fleet, that's no way to treat a lady.
Cal set Hope on her feet. The horse nodded wildly as if laughing, and Cal tutted at his lack of remorse.
He's a joker.
He ran his hand down the horse's neck and gave him an affectionate slap.
But he'd never hurt you.
Hope rubbed her breastbone over her clattering heart. Cal scratched beneath the horse's mane.
I need to apologize for the fact my dog's a deviant. It's a puppy thing. I stuck your, stuff in with a load of laundry.
She nodded, face still flushed.
What did your mom say?
Hope huffed and folded her arms.
She thinks I've turned into a raging slut.
Raging, huh?
He was genuinely amused. His rare smiles were infectious, and Hope couldn't help but smile back.
You should talk more, he added. Wasn't sure you could at first.
They watched each other.
Tired?
A bit.
but I need to stay awake.
Then let me show you something.
He led her over to a stall and pointed over the door. Inside was a beautiful black and white horse, and at its feet, folded up on the straw, a tiny white spindle-legged foal with bright blue eyes.
This is Zack, our newest addition. I was up most of the night with Gypsy.
Cal let himself into the stall.
Hey, girl, how you doing?
He pulled her pricked ears.
Want to come in?
Hope crept in cautiously and crouched by the foal with Cal.
Hey, little guy.
Cal stroked the foal's head. Gypsy looked over Cal's shoulder, unconcerned.
See his eyes? He's a throwback. They used to say horses with glass eyes were crazy, could never be tamed. Not true, is it, little guy?
The tiny foal snorted.
Yeah, exactly. Cal agreed. Not crazy at all. And every couple of generations, the pale eyes come round again.
He stood.
Want to help me finish up with the hay?
Yes, please. Well, if you like. He looked at her.
You want to or not?
She nodded. At the back of the barn, he had been shaking out clods of packed hay freed from a large bale and pushing them into net bags. About 10 already sat on the floor around them. He passed Hope a net, then took another. She copied him, shaking out handfuls and stuffing the hay into the nets. It was a while before he spoke.
So, you want to be a scientist?
No, I'm rubbish at it. I want to be a writer. She waited for the usual reaction, a smirk or a joke, but he just nodded and carried on working. When they had filled the last hay nets, they went out into the sunshine, and Hope watched as Cal dunked them all in a large rain butt, standing up against the barn.
So the dust doesn't make them cough.
Then he hung them over the doors of each stall, speaking to the horses as he went. Done, he came back to Hope and checked his watch. He was covered in hay dust, and his face was dirty.
Okay, it's after 6. But you should come and meet Chuck.
He led her outside to a series of pens made out of dense posts and rails. Cal drew her forward, indicating she should climb up next to him on the planks. He hung over the top rail, long arms dangling a net towards a fully grown buffalo bull standing in the middle of the pen. Hope climbed up another plank from Cal and stood up tall, looking at the huge animal. Why Chuck?
As in steak?
Hope stared at the massive hulk of the buffalo blowing softly through his nostrils as he contemplated the hay net. She looked at his dark coat and the lighter-coloured curly mop between his horns. You don't mean... Cal nudged her shoulder with his.
Nah, of course I don't mean that. He's one of the best breeding bulls in the States. Charles Mayweather Austin is his real name. Chuck, for short. But this guy will never be beef. Dad is, like, totally in love with him. You should see it. Chuck? Come on, you big flirt. Come and play.
Chuck lumbered towards Cal's outstretched hand and the hay. He blew on the net for a few seconds before snatching a few strands and munching as Cal rubbed his head. Hope kept her hands well away until Cal took one and placed it on Chuck's curls, his fingers sending little sparks up her wrist. Chuck carried on pulling at the net with his long purple tongue, snatching out wisps of hay.
See? Harmless.
If he's harmless, why have you got him in this tiny pen? Cal's head tipped to one side.
Oh, well... Most of the buffalo stuff is artificial insemination, genetics and all that. But Dad's big on keeping them as naturally as possible, so Chuck here,
gets to pay a few house calls over the summer. But first, it helps if you keep him here for a few hours each day and feed him up a little. Power, nutrition, that kind of thing. And frustration. They think that helps too.
Hope began to laugh.
You so have to talk to my mother about this. She'll have a whole view about how Chuck is representative of the worst of modern male society.
She realized their hands were still touching and pulled away, letting her hair fall into her face.
Mention the house calls, and we may have an international diplomatic incident on our hands.
He was laughing.
I think I've caught on to the fact your mom's into women's rights. This is modern Montana, not the old West.
You wouldn't know it from that policeman. What did he mean? About you?
Cal stopped laughing and jumped down from the edge of the corral.
Nothing.
He walked away. Back in the house, Hope wrestled with the remote to turn on the television. The huge screen finally came to life, showing unfamiliar American news. She went to the kitchen and opened the fridge in search of a bottle of water.
What do you want?
Cal asked from behind her, Buddy at his heels. She jumped.
Oh, just water, please.
He reached over her shoulder, tugging a water out of a drawer half filled with beer stamped Moose Drool, cracking the top and handing it to her. He was wearing a fresh shirt and jeans. His hair was damp and pushed away from his face, and his feet were bare. He smelt like washing powder and sun-warmed skin as he pushed the door closed. Hope took a sip of water.
Where's your dad if you and your mom travel like this?
Cal asked.
Not around.
See him much?
She twisted the cap back on.
Never met.
He cocked an eyebrow.
Come and sit outside?
Hope followed him out to the seating on the terrace. The house was on the side of a rolling hill, which terminated abruptly in a steep drop. Beyond it was a plain, rising into the mountains to the west towards which the sun was dropping. He collapsed into a chair, gesturing for her to do the same.
You've never met your dad.
She hesitated for a second.
Dad left us for his pregnant girlfriend when I was 6 weeks old.
Cal raised an eyebrow. Hope nodded.
Yeah, I know.
Mum hadn't meant to get pregnant. She was right at the end of her PhD. And my dad was this rising star in the theatre. He's loads older, and he and the other woman, they were starring in the same play. They have two boys, James and Tom. Mum got sole custody of me, but she'd already filled out my birth certificate with his name. That's why I'm a Cooper, not a West. It needles her like crazy. The not seeing each other, ever, me and him. Legally, that only lasted until I was 16. So now, we could meet up.
And what does your mum think of that?
Hope blew out a long breath.
What do you think?
He was silent for a few seconds.
Tricky.
Taking a sip from her water, Hope nodded. He sends me tickets for everything he's in. Sent an email asking me if I wanted to visit the set of his new TV series. He seems nice, apart from the abandoning.
So why not?
Why not what?
See him. He's your father. You should, if you ask me. Which you didn't.
His phone rang. He pulled it out of his jeans pocket with a bit of difficulty and answered it.
Excuse me for a second.
Hey, Maddie.
Hope could hear the voice on the end of the line, but not what they were saying. Cal's eyes flicked to her.
Yeah, got in this afternoon. 30 minutes late, but no big deal. Picked up the stuff from the store. I'll call you later.
Dude, Be quiet. Gotta go. He clicked the phone off without another word.
That's Joe's son. He's my best friend. But man, can he talk?
He shoved his phone on the table. It buzzed with a text message almost instantly, lighting up the screen. Hot or not? Cal snatched up the phone and killed it.
Did I also mention he's an asshole?
Hope stifled a laugh. He stood.
Could use some help with dinner if you're up to it.
Cal made cooking fun, even when he laughed at Hope for not being able to reach the rice on the top shelf in the walk-in pantry.
Sorry, it's too high, she called. Look at all this stuff.
She stared around her at the groaning, orderly shelves. He reached over her head and grabbed the bag.
We order most of our stuff in bulk through the Black Eagle stores. The guys cook for themselves in the bunkhouse.
She chopped as instructed and handed over each ingredient as they talked, shyness fading as the minutes ticked by. They were standing over the stove when she smothered a sudden series of yawns.
If you just make it through dinner, maybe you should crash then.
Mum says I have to stay up until 10.
Hope yawned again.
Not sure you'll make 8.
He was right. Hope was so exhausted she could barely eat anything. Meredith questioned Caleb Crowe about the ranch as Cal served the food. Once, as his father took a long pause before answering one of Meredith's more pointed questions, Cal caught Hope's eye and winked. She hid a smile. And I believe this area is remarkable for the diversity of the Native American tribes, Meredith went on. Caleb Crowe nodded.
Yep. Lots of different peoples up here, different reservations.
I've read about the social conditions on reservations.
There is a high incidence of domestic abuse and addiction.
So help me God.
Hope stared at her plate.
Here we go.
They got all the ordinary human problems, I guess. Biggest one, probably, was being rounded up 150 years ago and told to live a certain way.
Caleb Crowe carried on eating.
It's a touchy subject, Cal said, refilling the glasses. There's still a lot of racism.
Social conditioning is very powerful, Meredith said.
Treating other folks with dignity and respect is powerful too,
Cal's father said, to no one in particular. Afterwards, Hope helped Cal clear up, while Caleb and Meredith moved next door. Her head ached, and she rubbed her temples as she finished loading the dishwasher. A few seconds later, she heard something rattle, and Cal stood before her with a glass of water.
You look done in.
She took it gratefully. He gestured to the stairs with a tilt of his head.
Go on. I'll finish up here.
Conscious she was disobeying her mother's instructions, Hope climbed the stairs to her bedroom. Soon she was washed and changed and slipping into the cool white bed. The stars shone through the uncurtained windows, and above the black of the tree line and the line of the bluff, the moon was a huge white disk in the sky. She woke with a start, feeling both very awake and seriously headachy. There was a grey pre-dawn light outside. She looked at her watch, saw it wasn't quite 5, and groaned. Getting up, she splashed water on her face and pulled on her dressing gown, deciding she needed some coffee. Heading downstairs, she could smell that someone had beaten her to it. Just then, the front door opened, and Cal came in with his father.
Morning, Miss Hope,
the older man said. Cal closed the door, towing off his boots.
We made some coffee before checking on the horses. Want some?
Yes, please.
She rubbed her eyes.
How'd you sleep?
His father asked her.
Good, thank you. But it's too early.
Yeah, I hear jet lag's a kicker. Cal poured out 3 mugs of coffee. How do you take it?
Like that.
She took the mug from him.
Thanks.
They all sat at the counter. Hope gestured around them.
Your house is amazing.
Caleb Crow nodded.
It's the original homestead, but we just opened it out this year, put in the big staircase.
It's very beautiful.
He looked pleased.
So, what are you gonna do today?
She shrugged.
Get on with my projects, I guess.
He frowned.
Can't come all this way just to sit inside. Do you ride?
She shook her head.
Why doesn't Cal give you a lesson?
Hope didn't miss the sharp look Cal shot his father.
Oh, no, she said, shy again. It's fine, I don't need entertaining. I'm used to this. But thank you.
He was looking not at her, but at his son.
Misty's almost 30 years old. She loves to take care of a newbie.
Dad.
What? That old girl needs something to do with her days.
Cal's jaw was set.
Yeah, fine, sure, whatever.
Picking up his mug, he went outside into the pre-dawn through the large glass doors, Buddy loping onto the deck from the corner of the house. Hope examined her coffee cup. A large hand settled on her shoulder.
Pay him no mind, sweetie. It's not you.
Why?
Cal threw his coffee onto the grass and strode back into the house. Caleb and Hope stood in conspicuous silence.
If you want this lesson, you'll have to earn it.
30 horses to feed, all the water troughs to check before sunup.
Gypsy and Zack to look in on. Chuck, the girls.
What shoe size are you?
5.
English 5.
Fine. Get dressed. Jeans and a shirt or something.
It's cool out there this time in the morning. Don't bother showering. You can do that later.
In the flurry of orders, Hope stood, a little taken aback. Cal walked out, stamping into his boots on the porch. It was only then that she saw Caleb Crow grinning into his mug. 10 minutes later, Hope reported for duty by the front door. Cal was standing on the porch, looking out to where the horses gathered in the corrals and a slight mist rolled along the edge of the trees off to the right beyond the barn. The damp crept over the ground towards the house, and tiny